Hey everybody, this is Tyler. You're listening to the Lenny and Tyler Show, and it's just me today. I think on the last episode, Lenny returned, and we talked about how I was preparing for an interview with Mari Rudy. And so, kind of a sad update on that front. So, I was all prepared to interview Mari. And we had set aside a time, and everything was scheduled and, to do a Zoom call interview. Anyways, she didn't show up, for the interview on the Zoom call. And then a couple days later, I got an email from her saying that she was so sorry, but that she had to go to the hospital that morning. She had to go to the ER, and that she was actually writing to me from the ER, or from the hospital maybe. And anyways, about a month ago, I found out that Mari passed away, I think right at the beginning of June. And she had been battling some form of cancer for the last handful of years. I didn't really know much about it in our email correspondence back and forth. She just mentioned that she was dealing with some kind of a health problem. I kind of suspected that, there's a podcast called Why Theory that I listen to a lot. I've probably mentioned it on here in the past. And Todd McGowan is a good friend of Mari's. And he mentioned that that she had been battling cancer. So I eventually did, I guess, find that out through him. Anyways, so yeah, the interview that I had planned just never got to happen. And so I thought I'd just do just an episode updating anyone who has been listening that was anticipating that. And I think going forward with the podcast, you know, I'm so sporadic. I just sometimes get the itch to study a certain thinker or whatever, and just want to try to put whatever kind of insights I have, I want to try to solidify them into some kind of a medium of some kind. And so sometimes that's what this podcast is for me. Going forward, I think I'm reading a book called Capitalism and Desire by Todd McGowan. And a friend here in town named Joe is interested in Todd's work. He listens also to Why Theory a lot. And so we've just been reading the first chapter and over the phone discussing it, and are planning to do a recorded conversation about that book. And maybe we'll break it down chapter by chapter. We'll just kind of see how that goes. So let's see, for this episode, what do I want to, I guess mostly it's kind of this is just an update episode on everything that happened with Mari. And, you know, one day maybe I'll be able to interview, there's a few other people that I've been in contact with that, either knew Mari indirectly or are pretty familiar with her work. And so I've been able to just ask a few questions to some people online, some clarifying questions about psychoanalytic theory, and maybe one day I can interview one of them on this podcast. And I think that going forward, I would like to just try to do that more and more, to try to reach out to different authors who are working in this field, just to make sure that I'm not misinterpreting things, and just to scratch that that itch that I have. You know, there's something about when you spend a lot of time reading this material, but then you have nobody to really talk about it with. It just leaves you kind of wanting for something, wanting for community that you could discuss some of these interesting concepts with. So going forward, I'm hoping that if Joe gets really interested in this stuff, that he and I can have some good recorded conversations that we'll share on here with the podcast. Okay. So I was just this morning, I was actually a part of a little conference call with Peter Rollins and some of the people who, support his work on Patreon. And, one of the things that I brought up in the conversation with him is that, you know, his work, like Mari's, often starts with this concept of lack. For Mari, she talks about it as the contingent versus the constitutive lack. And for Rollins, he talks about it as the trauma that is you versus the traumas that happen to you. And I was able to kind of confirm in this little Zoom call this morning that those are basically equivalent. And if you haven't listened already, I know that I've done several episodes on the difference between these two forms of lack. But that's something that, Mari always emphasizes in her work. And there's very specific reasons why it's important that she do that. And, but the question I had for Peter was, because Todd McGowan also, I don't know that it's as clear, but that is, the constitutive lack at the, basically at the heart of every subjectivity is a big emphasis in his work as well. But sometimes it's almost like it ends there, and it's almost like just coming to accept that lack is it can sound like that's almost the end of the project that they're pushing for. But what I like about Mari so much is that she actually, it's almost like that acceptance of lack is kind of a first necessary step, but that there is something beyond that. And I would say that it's this, what she always emphasizes as this fidelity to the echo of the thing. And I know in several of the last podcasts that I've really emphasized this as well too. And that fidelity to the echo of the thing is a way to sidestep the demand of the superego to enjoy. So here's where I want to dive in a little bit more and just let's talk about what that demand to enjoy is. So the demand to enjoy comes from, well, it's in our culture today, and it's kind of everywhere, this sense that you're not living up to your best, to your fullest potential if you're not, like, happy all the time. And every commodity essentially is selling happiness. The people who are in the advertisements, they're always happy, and they're always you get the sense that they belong with the group that they're with, and so of course that evokes within us this anxiety that, oh my gosh, I wish I had the happiness and the sense of belonging that these people seemingly have. And then sort of subconsciously what gets ingrained is this sense that the product, the commodity that is near to them in the advertisement is the answer to what's the difference between me and them. And so that's one reason why we could say that we live in a society that is constantly giving this superegoic demand to become your authentic self, to enjoy, you know, life. Like you've been given so much opportunity. Like being sad or depressed is an affront to this like superegoic injunction. And so I was watching The Pervert's Guide to Cinema the other night. I like to go back and watch that once a year or so, because as I learn more and more about psychoanalytic theory, I can go back to that movie and understand what Slavoj Žižek is saying more and more in that. And there's a point in it kind of early on where he says, "My psychoanalytic friends are telling me that typically today, patients who come to the analyst to resolve their problems feel guilty not because of excessive pleasures, not because they indulged in pleasures which go against their sense of duty or duty and morality or whatsoever. On the contrary, they feel guilty for not enjoying enough, for not being able to enjoy." So, yeah, I guess, there's kind of this idea that, early on, we get our desire from, looking at the desire of the big other. And the big other early on for us is most likely our parent, either our mother or our father or both of them. And so we look to see where their gaze alights upon, and we try to discern what is it that makes that thing desirable. And even that's the case even when they look at us, that there's almost this anxiety that we feel of what is it about me that so captures their desire. And so this unknowing of why the big other, what and why the big other desires what they desire, causes us to create fantasies. It also, later on, the function of the big other, I think anyways, is with us forever. That we are basically always trying to please somebody, even if that somebody is kind of a virtual, non-embodied, real person in the world. It can almost be that in our age of social media, that the big other is like the algorithm. And I believe there's a guy named Matthew Flissfetter. I just listened to an interview with him on a book that he wrote called Algorithmic Desire. So when we are posting to social media and we're constantly taking these pictures, we're kind of constantly going, what does the Instagram want? What does what's going to get me the most amount of likes? What do I got to do to work the algorithm? What makes me desirable to kind of the way that all of that world is set up? That's kind of what, in that sense, the Big Other is functioning through the algorithm. We are trying to discern what it wants from us. And so the demand that we perceive from that Big Other these days is that we perceive that what it wants from us is for us to enjoy all the time and to be posting all the ways that we are enjoying all the time. And so that is why, you know, this is a, like, figuring out how to wrestle with that superegoic demand is basically the work that Peter Rollins is engaged in. And, you know, he is trying to set up these communities, these spaces where that superegoic demand is lifted and where these spaces where you can be okay in your not okayness. Basically these spaces where it's like you're accepted just as you are. So these spaces of grace. I would say that for Mari Rudy, her books and her emphasis on it's almost like a muscle, I would say, on getting good at sensing the echo of the thing. That's almost like her form of ethics, and that when you are attuned to that echo, you kind of dislodge yourself from that incessant pursuit to enjoy every moment, or, you know, to enjoy in all the different ways that consumerist culture is telling us to enjoy, you know, whether it's get married, have a big family, have a nice home with a white picket fence, you know, have the nicest car, nicest, greatest car, boats, RVs, all of that kind of stuff. It's like maybe those, if you're desiring that, it might be that those aren't your, it's not, it might be that you're kind of getting swept up in the superegoic injunctions of our current times. And that if there's a hollowness that's there, somehow tuning back into what are the few small things that that almost, I would say, have chosen you before you chose them and that are beckoning to you. She likes to use the word summons, that summon you. And that as we remain faithful to those things, we actually become a lot more creative. We learn the art of sublimating. There's actually a great, great quote here at the beginning of Capitalism and Desire. And for this first chapter in Capitalism and Desire, Todd McGowan he's talking through how we as capitalist subjects. Capitalism itself actually attaches to our compulsion to repeat loss and sacrifice. And that's basically the Freudian death drive, that there's something in us that just gets satisfaction from messing things up, from messing up kind of who we are symbolically in the world. And it gets some kind of satisfaction from repeating loss. And there's maybe later I'll go into why that is. But here he, at a certain point, he gives some examples of like a different form of subjectivity that has figured out how to loose themselves from the chains of the capitalistic, superegoic demand to enjoy. And he says, subjects who do not accept this fantasy are not continually seeking new objects of desire, and thus are not good consumers or producers, and they inevitably put a wrench in the functioning of the capitalist system. They content themselves with outmoded objects and recognize the satisfaction embodied in the object's failure to realize their desire. Such subjects do not simply settle for less than satisfying objects, as if they were proponents of the reality principle, but instead see their satisfaction in the object's inadequacy. For this type of subject, the fact that the car has a dent in the fender and hesitates going up hills becomes the source of the satisfaction that it provides. So he's not saying, he says, these subjects don't simply settle for less than satisfying objects as if they were proponents of the reality principle. So there is kind of, you know, there is, I guess, this potential to, you know, sort of sidestep this by becoming kind of hard bitten and going, look, you know, there's nothing in this world that can satisfy my desires anyways. So, you know, the reality principle just kind of is like, you just have to settle, and resign yourself to that, kind of hard, cold truth. And that's almost, to me, like the first step in this, of it, the acceptance of lack, of constitutive lack. And that all, I'm pretty sure in past episodes I've talked about that, but the constitutive lack is there because of the way that language rips us away from unfettered jouissance, unfettered access to doing whatever the hell we want. Or at least that's what we retroactively, it's interesting because we actually never had that unfettered access to enjoyment all the time. But when we're told no at a young age, then we retroactively perceive that we did have kind of like a unrestrained access to enjoyment. And so language itself is what is our birth into the symbolic, which has to do with language, is what creates this sense of lack within us, according to Lacanian theory. Okay. And so, so Todd there in that is kind of advocating for a kind of subjectivity that is able to look at what it already has and sublimate it, which means is able to elevate the ordinary object to the dignity of the thing. That's the terminology that they use. They're able to look at all of the failures in the thing that they have, and it's precisely because of all of those imperfections that they love it all the more. And Todd's like favorite example of this is in the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, John Candy, who at one point, you know, their vehicle gets lit on fire at night, and then the next morning, and so it's just a burnt crisp, like, and they're driving down the road, and in this burnt out car the next day in the winter, and there's no more roof, the windows are all broken out. Anyways, they're going down the highway, and I think maybe he's even speeding, and anyways, they get pulled over, and the police officer is like, do you think that this car is safe for safe for highway use? And John Candy just very candidly goes, yes, I do, officer. Yes, I do. And he goes on to sort of praise the vehicle for, you know, the speedometer doesn't work, but the radio is still clear as a whistle. And there's like this, you kind of get this sense that John Candy loves it not in spite of its imperfection, but precisely because of its imperfection. I think maybe that's the way to put it. And so that is for Todd, an example of the kind of subject that is freed from the demand to enjoy. And I think that that's actually really similar to what Mari is talking about, too, with her emphasis on remaining faithful to the echo of the thing. Okay, so let me see if I can find a nice quote from Mari. So I like this little quote from The Singularity of Being on page 144. You know, as just almost like a scene that could be an example of what paying attention to the echo of the thing might look like in the everyday kind of mundane necessity of having to go, you know, buy clothes, buy clothes from a store so that you have something to wear. So she says, where a given person finds this aura, the echo of the thing, where they find it is absolutely idiosyncratic, so that an item I find completely banal might elicit a strong reaction from someone else. I suspect that many of us are familiar with the tingling sensation that comes over us when we chance upon the perfect article in a crowded store. We might have spent hours looking for something worth purchasing when this article suddenly calls on us from some inconspicuous corner or from underneath a pile of kitschy trinkets. Personally, I have turned shopping into an effortless activity by having unconditional faith in this process, so that I can determine within a couple of minutes whether a particular store holds any promise or not. I scan the articles in a fairly absent-minded manner, and if nothing leaps at me immediately, I move on. In a given year, I might spend less than 2 hours shopping for clothes, yet I always seem to have ones that feel right. So I like that as just kind of a like a example of just this mundane, like somehow attuning yourself, even in something as simple as shopping. Attuning yourself to the echo of the thing, and to really not settle for less than that, to not go, well, you know, I gotta, my life needs to look this certain way because, you know, that's what people in my age group and, you know, kind of category of life, that's what they're supposed to be. If it's not evoking the echo of the thing, if these, you know, different, like owning a house or getting married or, you know, whatever it is, being in a relationship, if that's not something that is calling you, then maybe you're doing it, I guess I would say, then you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And that you'll find that as you attune yourself to remaining faithful to the specificity of your desire, that actually anxiety and this sense of guilt actually really diminishes. So here's another quote that I like from her. Even though we often fall for the seduction of hollow objects and representations that can only give us a shallow and usually short-lived satisfaction, we do usually know when we have stumbled upon the real thing, be it in the form of a pair of shoes or a beloved person. We know when we have discovered something that is not easily replaceable. In other words, we may err by attributing the luster of the thing to too many objects. We may, on occasion, let ourselves be fooled by shiny lures, but we rarely hesitate in the face of the genuine article. So there is something about us that's able to really, really hone in on things that have the echo of the thing. And the only thing that I'd say about that, though, that I'm not sure that they talk about too much, but I think somewhere in her work she talks about this. When you do find something that contains an echo of the thing, you're both drawn to it, and I think it is it's disruptive, and it can getting too close to it, I would say, especially like with a person, can be disorienting and can, it's hard to maintain, a proper distance from when it's with another person, from collapsing into each other and, almost there's this thing. It's like with the thing, you're drawn to it because it's almost like it's going to obliterate you, which is kind of like almost what is alluring about it, but also at the same time, you know, it's terrifying. So it really is like it's intoxicating, but it does have its toxicity. So that's where I think it takes a while to understand how to revolve around the thing without getting totally sucked into its orbit and losing control and having collapse of relationship, especially when it's with another person, in which you evoke their thing and they evoke your like for who, for when it's for each other, you are each other's thing, evoke each other's thing. That's like the potential for the greatest relationships, but also, it can be hard. It comes with its own kind of dangers, because it's like almost getting too close to what you desire. So anyways, trying to think if there's anything else to say. Probably not. In the future, maybe I'll try to talk more about jouissance and toxicity, and because I was just talking with Michael Downs of the Dangerous Maybe blog, and one of the things that we were talking about that is like one of the coolest parts of psychoanalytic theory is that it actually can make you a more loving person to others and to yourself, because when you begin to realize that people are people can't help but be drawn to certain forms of repetition, that we get our satisfaction from repeating loss in idiosyncratic ways, that often that is what drives other people away, that the annoying habits of a roommate or a friend or a spouse or a family member, those annoying habits are what give that person some form of satisfaction. And we have that too. Every single person has that. And so understanding how that mechanism works will help to make you a more loving person, loving and accepting toward those people who just drive you crazy, but also will help you to understand and make space for the parts of yourself that remain puzzling even to you. So maybe we can talk more about that in the future in more depth. Anyways, if you've listened this far, thanks for listening, and take care. Sometime check out some of Mari Rudy's work. She was an awesome person. There's a great podcast episode on Y Theory called A Tribute to Mari Rudy. Todd talks about her as a paradigm, that she was paradigmatic of her own thinking of the singularity of being. That just even that title, you know, to unpack the meaning of that would be an interesting endeavor in the future. The singularity, well, yeah, no, I'm not even going to try to unpack that here at the last minute. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. My voice is kind of going out. And hopefully we'll have some new episodes here sometime soon. Thanks.